Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with actress Michelle Monaghan. When I first met Michelle, her film career was just starting to take off, thanks to her performance as a would-be actress in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. Kind of ironic when you think about it. Growing up, Michelle didn't aspire to be an actress. Instead, she was working her way through a Columbia journalism degree. And when she did discover her passion, she suddenly found herself playing opposite Richard Gere, Robert Downey, and Tom Cruise with almost no idea what she was doing. Those early experiences were scary, but for Michelle, fear and motivation are synonymous. She's earned increasing respect for her work in roles that rely less on her looks and more on her emotional intelligence. And she's surprising a lot of people in the process, with projects like Fort Bliss, True Detective, and her new series, The Path, on Hulu. Michelle may have left Columbia a few credits short of a degree, but she told me her studies have served her craft in unexpected ways, as has her training at the prestigious Dootson School of Trucking. Obviously, Michelle and I had a lot to catch up on, so pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Michelle.
Hi.
So, I should say before we start anything that we met almost 10 years ago, and since then, your career, I mean, it's, you've worked so solidly on all these projects, Fort Bliss and Trucker and Kiss Kiss Bang Bang and True Detective and now The Path and these big blockbusters, Mission Impossible, Source Code. But when I met you, I think you were coming off of Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Yes.
And you had that air of, I don't know if you call it heat or you call it sizzle or whatever, but it was like you were sort of still the new person, but you'd already done a lot of work. And we met, I remember at this Chateau Marmont for a film that I had that never got made, which was an adaptation of David Foster Wallace's book, Infinite Jest. And I remember this meeting.
Gosh, here we go.
Because, you know, first thing you do before a movie is financed, you try to attach some actors to it. And there's this beautiful, amazing role, the lead female role in the film. And I wanted you for it. And yet, in the script and in the book, the lead, she wears a veil through the entire book. And subsequently through the entire movie until the very last scene. And I'm like, when are we going to get to the part where we discuss that I'm asking you to play a role where your face is covered for the whole movie? And I don't know, I'd love to hear your side of it, but I remember thinking, when is the veil going to come up?
That's funny that you bring that up. That's something that I'm drawn to in any role, something that's challenging to play like that and having to convey a feeling or an emotion or a story or a character despite what their flaws or you know, what may be hindering them or what may be covering their head.
Right.
So, if anything, you know, I was intrigued at that. And then, you know, at the end, there's an incredible reveal, you know? So there's always the payoff or, you know, there's something that's going to impact the story or this character. And so then, you know, that's the rhyme or reason to it.
Well, you know, it's funny, back then...
Now, I don't know what my agents would have said.
Well, that's the other thing. And those were the conversations with the producers, like, who can we get that's great that's going to actually wear this veil all the way through the movie?
Tell me what gal doesn't want to wear a veil, by the way.
Who wants to work on a film for, you know, 2 months and never... Yes, but... Looking back,
be the
on it
first
now,
time I wouldn't be worrying about a pimple on my face. Let me tell you that.
Well, that part's a positive. But I think now, you know, looking at your career and where you started, it does bring up a question about taking beauty out of the equation and being able to, you know, sort of have an audience focus on something else. Because I feel like that at that time also. I mean, when I think about the first time the cinema world saw you, it was this long tracking horizontal shot of you in this red dress and Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, and you're just this knockout, and you're in this film with Robert Downey, and who is this person, and she's carrying the movie, and it made me wonder, because I know you came from modeling, and you went a different route than most people, just made me wonder, like, if sometimes that would be a refreshing
situation compared to always being sort of judged on beauty? And is that a dumb
Certainly.
Question?
I mean, no, it's not a dumb question at all. But the character of Harmy, she was this woman. Or this young lady. Funny story about that is I had never dyed my hair in
my
life.
Yes, you were blonde in that film.
Yeah, and I have naturally a very dark hair, black hair. And we had done the read through the night before, and I was all over the place tonally. I actually thought that they were going to fire me that night, and I think maybe they were thinking maybe they might. I'd read with Downey for the part, and we had an amazing read. And then it was, you know, a month later, I think, that we finally all sat down and read the script together. And I think I was fresh off a plane from the Bourne Supremacy. I was literally 5 hours off the plane, and I was doing a read through and getting ready to start the film the next day. And I kind of was tonally all over the place. And then as we finished, I thought, oh my gosh, they're gonna fire me. For sure. And then Joel Silver looked at me and he said, and now you're gonna go get your hair blonde. And I was like, what? And he's like, oh yeah, you're gonna be blonde. So I sat in a hair salon in West Hollywood until about 2 a.m. because it took me 5 hours
to get it from
to get it black to blonde. And I remember waking up in my hotel room that morning at like 6 a.m. with only a few hours, scaring the shit out of myself when I looked in the mirror because I had forgotten I was blonde. And I remember like wanting to burst into tears because I looked awful. I was so fair and I had, you know, freckles and, you know, my hair wasn't done and I just didn't look like myself at all. And I remember walking across, you know, the set to the makeup and hair trailer, and Robert was like, whoa, 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 look at you. And he's like, do you like it? And I was like, yeah, I love it. It's beautiful. I was never going to say anything. And I'm thinking to myself, oh my gosh, how are they going to transform me, like, into this Hollywood, like, wannabe actress, you know, with the push-up bra and the whole thing. And they blew out my hair, and they put all this makeup on me, and put a push-up bra on me and a short dress and heels. And I went, wow, even I surprised myself. I was like, look at her. And immediately, I knew who she was, Harmony Faith Lane. She was, and, you know, that's why I'm always so indebted to hair and makeup and wardrobe, because they're just really, they transform you into who you are. And so that idea for that character, that that she was beautiful, like that's who she was. And so it was nice to sort of be able to be that. And then, you know, you take someone like Trucker or someone like in Fort Bliss, where it was just very natural. That was also a really beautiful departure, because I love that natural aspect in anybody, but the idea of beauty is always different in any character, but it's something that I take very seriously because I think it really conveys so much to the audience about who this person is when they wake up in the morning. How much time do they spend in front of the mirror, and do they wear deodorant, and do they wear a bra? You know, all of those things. Do they take the time to put mascara on, or do they just, like, you know, walk out the door and put their hair in a ponytail, you know?
Well, right, what you're saying is that you met this character when you saw yourself, and almost the fact that it was so different, that it allowed you to see the transformation that she had to make to think that she was gonna make it as an actress.
Exactly.
It's interesting because sometimes, as when you view a film, you think every decision was made with such clarity, but sometimes there's this moment of discovery that takes you by surprise,
oh,
right?
Oh, yes. I mean, I'm grateful, actually, that Joel Silver turned and looked at me, and I was never going to say no to Joel Silver, but I'm grateful because it completely took me out of my skin, and it forced me to look at myself in a whole new way. And I think in that, probably that moment, that next day, I tonally got the scene. I think the first scene that I shot was scene when we're leaving the hotel and I see Downey's, like, tag in the back of his
yes.
thing.
You know what's funny about that scene is you're watching it, you're going, oh my God, wardrobe person screwed up. For the first minute of that scene,
yeah.
you're like, I'm just focusing on that tag.
Yeah.
And then it gets fixed.
Yeah, and I think he'd made the choice to have his tag out. And then I remember him like me making that choice to tuck it back in. And he was like, that was good. That was good. And I was like, what? He was like tucking your tank. I mean, he taught me so much on that movie. I can't even tell you. Val and Robert in particular. You know, I improv for the first time. I didn't study acting. I had no idea what I was doing.
And for people who don't know, we should probably go back further.
Yeah.
Because you weren't the kid that at age 7 was like, I'm going to be an actress and that's it, right?
No.
I didn't know this, but you grew up with parents that were foster parents, mm-hmm. too. How many, like 12 kids?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's crazy to me. I mean, you're in the Midwest and your parents are, they're not from money, right?
No, they're very modest, humble beginnings, definitely.
How does someone become a foster parent? I mean, that's something you have to seek it out, mm-hmm. or is it something you fall into?
Well, my mom had actually run a daycare out of our home for 40 years, so we were always really used to having children run around. Both of my parents are extraordinary nurturers. And I remember the day that they sat us down and they said, you know, we're going to become a foster family. And I don't think any of us really understood.
How old were you?
I think I was about 8 or 9. And then I didn't quite know what it was. And they said, well, it's when children are having issues or families are having difficulty and, you know, parents need help and the children need help. And so we're going to take in those children less fortunate than us and we're going to help them. And so we started right then and there. The first one we had, we're still in contact. He came for 2.5 years. He came to us at 2.5 months old and he stayed with us until he was almost 3.
Oh my gosh.
And so that was heartbreaking when he left.
Yeah, I would imagine. It's like.
And I think for most people, it was really so devastating for us that I'm surprised that even my parents sort of said, okay, well, we're going to go back and do this again.
I mean, when you get a kid when they're that young.
Yeah.
It's like they're part of your family, right?
They are. You know, that was really informative to me and to my brothers. It certainly makes you have a lot of gratitude for what you have and, you know, and realizing that, you know, you can be born into any situation as a child. I remember my mom and dad always saying to me, I don't see them as dramatic people, but I always remember my mom saying this to me, you know, you are so fortunate to be born into this family, into this town, into this country, you know, in the circumstances in which you were born into, because you could have been born this way, that way, this way, or, you know, and I'll never forget that. And I think it allowed me at a very young age to imagine myself in somebody else's shoes, to have compassion. And it's something that I've reflected on a lot in the way that it's affected me and in terms of my career choice.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, it's one thing, we all tell our kids, you're so fortunate to have piano lessons, or you're so fortunate to go to the school that you get to go to, or live where you get to live. Mm-hmm. But your parents, they lived by example. It wasn't just, and I wonder how that made you look at your parents. And I mean, as a kid, did it ever feel like, I'm not getting enough attention?
It never felt like
that's
that.
That's amazing.
Ever. I only saw, because they led by example, I saw the changes in which these children underwent because my parents believed in them, because my parents nurtured them, because they sat around the table with us and we laughed and we cried and we did all these things. So if anything, it made me feel, it gave me faith in knowing that I could do whatever I wanted to do. Like, I never felt growing up that I was a victim of any sort of circumstance. I always sort of wanted to create my own sort of circumstances, and I never felt like I was limited by, even though I came from Iowa, you know, in the middle of Iowa, and you don't really dream big, but I never had a feeling like I couldn't do anything. My folks would always say to us, always follow your heart. That sounds so cliche. Always follow your heart. You have a good head on your shoulders. Just always remember that. You have a good head on your shoulders. I mean, just something like that. I mean, that was so encouraging to me.
Yeah. So did it occur to you that this could be a profession when you were young?
No.
See, I think that's interesting.
It didn't occur to me that it could be a profession until I was in my early 20s.
Isn't that wild?
To be honest, I'd really wanted to be a journalist growing up.
I read you were class president.
I was.
So I think of class presidents as like they're a little bit more mature and together than the other students.
Yeah.
And hearing you describe your family, that makes sense.
Yeah.
But why did you become class president?
That's a really good question. Because I came from a class of 39 people.
Yeah.
And I never played sports. I'd loved to. There is something in our school district called speech. And it's funny now when I look back, I'm like, of course I wanted to be an actress. I would go to speech, I would do debate, I would do speech where you would prepare monologues and you would go to the University of Iowa, for example, and you would have these speech competitions and people would do scenes together, or you'd have a monologue. And I did those and I did plays in high school, but I didn't grow up watching movies. The nearest movie theater was 45 minutes away.
Really?
We didn't have cable. But I remember the feeling that I got when I had those experiences of walking out on stage and panicking and then experiencing it was over. And then I was like, oh, did we just do that? And having such complete abandon.
So you would go so deep into it that
oh,
the time
yeah,
would just...
Oh, yeah, 100%. I tap into that so much, wanting to get back to that moment. I don't always have that moment when I'm working, but I know when I do, it's so truthful. So I remember that, but I always wanted to. I wanted to be an investigative journalist. I wanted to be an investigative reporter.
Based on what?
I think I was very idealistic. I still kind of am. I'm a little bit more realistic now. But I think because of probably my parents, you know, and sort of witnessing a lot of these things that children endured. Current events was very big in our home. We talked around the table. We read the newspaper. We were very informed as a family. And I really wanted to be a journalist. And I knew that if I wanted to study... that it was going to be something that I would have to put myself through school. And I thought, how can I manage this? And we went to a Cubs game. It was my first time to a big city, to Chicago, I think when I was like 16. And I remember seeing that skyline and I was like, holy shit. Oh my God. Walking around the city and seeing all these people. And I was so energized and it was so exciting. And I remember thinking, I really want to go to college in a big city. And coincidentally, at that time, I was sort of coming into my own as an adolescent, and people would say to my parents, you know, your daughter's very pretty. She could probably model or something. And I remember like seeing somebody in Iowa, a scout from Chicago at the same time, and I thought, and they said, you know, from Elite, and they said, you should come in. And my folks drove me in, and I sat down with them. And they said, yeah, you could do Montgomery Ward modeling. You could do Target, all this stuff. And I thought, and my folks let me go to Chicago for the summer to live in a modeling apartment to
How
model.
How old were you?
I was 17.
No kidding. So they're like, this is, you can't pass this
you
up.
You can't pass this up. This is an amazing opportunity. You have a good head on your shoulders. You're only 4 hours away. You're going to be fine. And I was fine. I made money. And I was like, wow, I made some money. And at that point, I realized, you know what? I can go to school. I can get my degree at Columbia, my journalism degree. And I'll work during the day and I'll take night classes. So that's what I did.
It's amazing that you didn't go that route and go, I can go to New York and I can kill it as a model.
Yeah, but eventually, my senior year, I was doing really well in school. I was, you know, a good student. I was on the dean's list. I loved what I was doing.
You were an overachiever.
I was an overachiever, totally over, big time overachiever. Total type A. But also, you know, it was my money on it. You know, this was like, I was working and, you know, I wasn't about to like sort of waste my money. I was going to do well, you know, putting myself through school.
And there was no money from your folks, like...
Oh, no.
For college.
No.
It was either going to be student loans or...
Yeah, yeah. And then all of a sudden, at the same time, I went through a terrible breakup, and I was sort of getting a little bit disenchanted with the idea of being a journalist, and I realized it wasn't about sort of, you know, started doing, like, internships, and it wasn't about, like, sort of finding the story as it was much as creating the story. And I was like, it didn't feel really authentic to, like, this idealistic sort of approach that I had, right? Or righting all the wrongs, and then here comes, like, all the drama, you know? So then I was like, you know what? That's it. I'm dropping out of college, and I'm going to move to New York. Something's going to happen for me there. I was only, like, you know, 2 semesters shy of graduating. And I called up my folks, and I said, Mom, Dad, I'm dropping out of school. I'm going to move to New York. They were like, what? You're going to move to New York? And I said, I don't know. I have this crazy feeling something's going to happen for me there. They were like, what? And I said, I know. They're like, are you sure? And I said, yes. And here we go again. Well, you've always had a good head on your shoulders. And I was like, what am I doing? A week later, they picked me up in a U-Haul. They drove me out to New York. I moved in with a friend. I continued modeling for lack of anything else to do. I started doing some commercials, making money.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, a television series called Young Americans was on the WB. Kate Bosworth, Kate Minnig, Ian Somerhalder was on it. They said, you know what, you should go in and audition for it. You've had good luck. And I thought, okay.
And was that through your commercial agent or your
Yes. And then...
So you had that sort of natural progression of...
Yeah, it all just sort of...
She's modeling, but let's see if we can get her some
commercial
work.
Yeah, and I got the gig. And I was like, wow, okay. And then that night, I was on a train to Baltimore to start this gig. And I had no idea what I was doing. But it was fun. And when I finished those few episodes, I thought, you know what? I could really make some money at this. This might help me out. This could tide me over until I figure out what I'm really supposed to do.
Wait a minute.
So I said, someday
I got to figure out what I'm supposed to do.
It's still not like hitting me. I'm still like kind of, you know, not getting it. And I make some phone calls and I meet with some agents. And I sit down with my still agent that I have today, Bonnie Bernstein. And I meet with her and I say, you know what? I don't know if I'm meant to do this, but I promise I'll work really hard. And I say, I think maybe I'm supposed to do it. I don't know, but I just moved here and I think that I should get an agent. And she goes, well, you know what? I believe in you and I promise and I believe that you will work hard. And that was it. And then it was about a few months later, I got an audition for Unfaithful.
Oh yeah, right.
And I have a scene, most of my scenes get cut out of that movie ultimately, but what was the moment that I realized that this is what I was meant to do was when Richard Gere is getting ready for a really big emotional scene, and I'm his secretary, and I walk into his office, and he's going to say that I recognize that something's not right. And all of a sudden, we're prepping for the scene. All of a sudden, this music comes on, and I see Richard getting into character. Now, what I know is, like, getting into character, and the music's really, really intense, and he's over in the corner sobbing. And I'm standing in front of a light, and I'm just looking around, like, looking at everybody. And I'm like, does everybody know he's, like, something's wrong?
Maybe we should take a break.
Something's wrong. But everybody's really respectful, and it's really quiet, so I'm like, okay. And then he turns around, and he's like, okay, I'm ready. And I'm like, okay, rolling. And then all of a sudden, I'm like, oh no, this is acting. Like, this is what he's doing. And he comes up, and all of a sudden, I got emotional myself, and the camera was on him. And I was like, are you okay? And I was like, in character, but I got really emotional. And I was like, getting emotional even recalling it, because it was so real. And I was like, are you okay? And we start saying the lines, and it was so powerful. And we finish the scene, and he takes my hand, and he goes, thank you. And he walks back to the corner, and he gives me the thumbs up. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this was just like such a moment in time, I can't even believe it. And in that moment, I thought, oh my gosh, this is what I'm meant to do. And I remember finishing work that day, and I walked to Bryant Park, and I sat down on a bench, and I cried. And I cried like I couldn't believe, like a baby. Because I went, oh my gosh, this is what I moved to New York for. This is what I knew was gonna happen. This was that moment where it realized, and in that moment, this is the final bit of the story. I said, if I ever see him again, and he actually called my agent, and he'd said, like the following day, Adrienne Lyon called and said, you know, really complimentary things about me as an actress. It was amazing. Such a vote of confidence for me and for her. And I thought, you know what, I'm so indebted to him. If I ever see Richard Gere again, I'm going to say thank you. So years later, I'm at the Four Seasons Hotel doing a junket for Maid of Honor. And he's there with Diane Lane, coincidentally, doing a Nicholas Sparks movie. Is it Message in a Bottle or I don't know, whatever movie it is. And I see that they've got their posters around and I'm like, oh my gosh, this is it. I'm gonna see Richard today. I'm gonna find him on my lunch break. I'm gonna say thank you because I promised I always would. And there he is. I see him coming in from the lawn or whatever, and I see Richard, and he looks at me, and I say, hi, Richard, I don't know if you remember, my name is Michelle Monaghan. I was in a movie called Unfaithful, and it was such a meaningful experience to get to work with you. I don't know if you're welcome. He's like, oh, okay. And I said, you know, we had a scene, and it was a really amazing scene for you, and I said, but I'll never forget after that scene you gave me a thumbs up, and it forever changed my life, my course in my life, and I just felt like if I ever saw you again, I must say thank you. You were a pleasure to work with. And he was like, great, good to see you. Oh my God, I was like, it was such an amazing moment.
He turns to his sister like,
But I loved it. I loved it at the same time, and I loved telling that story because I put so much stock in that, and rightfully so, because he was so in the moment, and it was such a beautiful gesture that he gave me. But of course he's not gonna remember. You know, he was just like doing his job going, thank you, I needed that. And now he's moved on.
Right.
But what that did for me as a young actor just starting out was invaluable.
He's like, great, can you give me a cup of coffee?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So.
No, but you know, it does bring up that point of sometimes the most significant moments, they coalesce into something, and no one else knows that's going on. Hearing that story, it makes me realize that some people don't get that moment ever.
Yeah.
You know, some people don't ever find that thing or have it so.
Like ding dong.
Such a period on it. But it was going to happen. It was going to happen somewhere. It happened to be Richard Gere, but it was going to happen.
Exactly. And it took me until I was about, you know, 22 or 23. And it's interesting. I say, you know, be patient and persevere and be open to learning and experiencing and grow that thick skin. You know, I think I was really fortunate that I had all those years of modeling because if anything will build you thick skin, it's that. I never had any issues of, you know, I auditioned tons and rejected, you know, still even today, but I don't bat an eyelash because it's, you know, it's one of those things. And so I'm lucky that I kind of went through that with the modeling stage, but, you know, it's okay if it takes you a few years to get going, you know, perhaps it's meant to.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, you sort of landed in a few things. Mm-hmm. Accidentally, and you've talked about having no formal training, but I wonder if once that Richard Gere moment happens, if it's like someone who sees the Grand Canyon for the first time, and you realize the depth. I mean, that had to be terrifying, also, to go, wait a minute, I have so much to learn, or so.
Oh yes, I mean that was a gift to watch that. You know, I remember as a young kid, you know, sort of making myself cry that I would imagine. Sort of all these sort of experiences and, or just, I never had any trouble sort of conjuring up an imagination or an idea or an emotion, right? I think everybody does that. Maybe not.
I made myself cry this morning.
Did you?
Yeah, it's
a beautiful thing. Did you?
No.
Oh, I'm very gullible.
My daughter almost made me cry this
morning. She did?
Yes.
Okay.
Piano practice was difficult this
morning. Okay, all right, got you.
No.
But I remember, you know, when he did that, I was like, oh, this is what acting is. You find a moment and you tap into an experience or an emotion or a memory or a desire, whatever it is. And that did. That opened the floodgates for me. I mean, I that's like a method. I don't have any method except for my method of instincts,
right.
Truly.
Well, tell me about once you sort of knew that this is what you wanted to do and you had to... you had to carry this new knowledge that this is what you're meant for into auditions.
Mm-hmm.
Like, do you remember those early days of going after things?
I do. And I always sort of say, I say this to young actors as well, there were times where I just knew maybe the role, I definitely wasn't right for the role, but it was an opportunity to go in and meet a casting director. And I thought, you know what, I might not be right for the role, or it might be over my head, but you know what, I'm gonna make a good impression personally, hopefully, maybe on the casting director, or
yeah,
the producers, and maybe they'll invite me back in for something that is better or more suited to me. You know, I also remember telling myself to always be off book, to have all those lines memorized. I still do it because I feel like when you look down at the page, that's where all your subtext is. I feel that's one of the most powerful tools that you have as an actor, is to say so much without saying anything.
Right.
And so when you're looking at somebody and somebody's saying their line and you're not responding to them, you know, visually, you're not conveying an emotion visually, which everyone does, but if you're too busy looking down at your next line to see what that is, then you've lost a really opportune moment.
Right.
So I really remember learning that. And that wasn't right off the bat, but just to be off book, so I was constantly connected to whoever I was reading with or with the camera.
How much was fear a motivator?
Oh, always. Fear is a motivator in everything, in every decision that I do. I remember for Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, I had to audition with Shane. It was the first audition, and I flew in from New York, because I was living there for many years. And I was staying at a hotel, and it was about 2 hours before I went in, and I called up Bonnie, my agent, to be like, I can't do it. It's just like, it's too much, right?
And why was that one? Why was that one like
I don't
on the
know.
Too much character? Because the role was so huge.
The role was so big. It was like, it was really like a lead role.
Yeah.
And the role was so rich. I mean, there's so much color to that character. I don't know if I just felt like it was over my head. I don't know. And I remember calling her up to say, you know, I can't do it. I'd never done that before. And her assistant picks up and she's like, oh, hold on, I'll get her. And then I went, and I hung up the phone, and I think I said, that means you have to do it. And I was like, that was it. And I went in and I had the most amazing audition with Shane. And then it was a few months later for me to be able to sit down with Robert. But it's always a motivator. You know, there's so many films that I think like, oh no, I can't do, like I remember Trucker. I thought I got the role for Trucker, and I thought, oh, there's no way I can play a truck driver. And I was like, there's no way I'm not getting my truck driver's license. You know, if I don't get my truck driver's license, then there's no way I'm gonna play the role, you know? And I was like, there's no way I can do it. And I was like, no, I have to do it. I have to go get my truck driver's. I have to go to truck driving school and get my, you know, my Class A license. I remember going out. It's out on the 10, this truck, Dudson's truck driving school. I remember walking in there that day, and I was sitting there with like 8 truckers, male truckers, and they were said, you don't look like a truck driver. And I was like, well, I'm gonna be one. And I was like, oh my God, did I just say that? I thought, oh shit, oh my God, I can't believe I just said that. And then—
But that's your method, right?
That's my method. And I was like, oh my, I grew up with brothers too, mind you. So, you know, that's another place where I get my thick skin. But I was like, I'm gonna be one. And I passed, and oh my, it was like gold, this license.
And in the back of your mind, are you thinking, if this acting thing doesn't work out,
yeah,
I can always drive a truck.
I can always drive a truck. I don't even know how to drive a regular stick shift. But I can drive an 18-wheeler with like a double clutch and like, you know, 12 gears and a splitter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that may be the sexiest thing you've ever done.
Yeah. Right.
What is the splitter?
Yeah.
I don't even want to know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, so getting back a little bit to that idea of learning on the job.
Yes.
I did hear you once say you didn't know what improv was until you had to improv with probably one of the greatest actors in the world.
Yeah.
So tell me that story, because I find that, like, that is the, that's the definition of coming to this town and, like, hustling your way into something and then having to figure it out and take a risk.
There was a scene, it was, again, one of our first days at the Standard Hotel, where it's right before the
Kiss Kiss Bang Bang,
and it's right before the spider scene. So we're walking into the hotel room, and I think I start to disrobe, and we're talking about sort of the night's events. And Shane's in one of the other rooms, sort of with the Video Village. And Robert looked at me right before we walked in, and he had gum. He decided, he said, who's got gum or who's got something? And he was like, okay, we're gonna improv this. And I was like, what? He's like, we're gonna improv this scene. And I was like, I had no idea what he was talking about. I was like, what are you talking about? We're gonna improv this scene. He was like, it means we're not gonna say the words on the page. I'm not gonna say the words, like, we're not gonna say, like, Shane's words. And I was like, oh, okay. And we walked in.
And what are you thinking? Are you thinking there's an alternate script that he has?
I am absolutely, I have no idea what to think, but my heart is racing a mile a minute. And I don't know if we even used some of it, but it was like the stick of gums, or we're shooting this, and I don't know about this. And I had no idea what I was doing, but I just did it. It's like you just jump off the deep end and you follow your lead, and he's my lead, and you trust him. And I trusted him, obviously, implicitly. He encouraged me every single day. He was so supportive and complimentary and just said, keep doing whatever you're doing. But that was a moment of, like, complete and utter, like, fear of just, I had no idea. And still, to this day, somebody says, let's improv, and you do it on every film. It's a great tool to use as well. I'm like, oh, God, now I have to be clever. You know, it's like, oh, gosh.
Well,
you know?
It ties into what you said earlier about, you know, thinking you're going to be fired. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that still a fear?
Oh, my gosh. Do you know what I still really love and appreciate is going in and auditioning and getting the job? Because at least when I turn up on the day, on the very first day, I'm like, well, they saw what I did. They approved of it. So I've got their stamp of approval. You know, I'm very fortunate to be in the position where people offer me things. But I must say that I do a lot of work, obviously, prior to my first day. Hopefully, most of my work is complete. And that when I turn up, I've got a pretty full, flushed out character in my mind. And I'm thinking, wow, they may have a completely different idea of what I'm gonna do.
That's
and
so
then I think, you know, then I think they could just fire me and go, you know, that's not at all what we signed up for. You know? So I do, I really do, I like the idea of, you know, sort of showing what I wanna do, kind of conveying that. I can do that also in meetings and sitting down, but at some level I feel I like to be in the skin of the character and sort of show them. And if it's not what they want, it's not what they want. But at least I know if I turn up and, you know, we've agreed to it, then I'm safe.
I always think it's interesting for someone who doesn't have formal training. Mm-hmm. They have to develop their own system. Have you sort of found a system that works for you?
I found it, interestingly enough, inadvertently. I write a lot about my characters, who they are.
So do you write, like, backstory
journals? I write backstory, all of that. But what I realized that I was doing, and I learned it on Gone Baby Gone, it was Angie Gennaro, my character I played. She was a private investigator. And I realized when I was writing that character, I was using the 5 W's in the how. I write as a journalist. I write their story.
Interesting.
The who, what, when, where, why, and how. And then in that moment, I went, oh my God, it wasn't all for naught. That was a part of my journey. I was supposed to go to school. I've used it, thank God, like all that money I spent. But so that's my method, and I still use that, actually. That's my method in my who, what, when, where, why, and how.
And this isn't work that even the director needs to know, right?
No. It's all work that you do on your own that just gives me those layers, you know, that informs me with every sort of decision or choice you make, you know.
How does that change for TV? Because you're always getting new information and new scripts. Is it the same process, or does it have to be a little more flexible?
It has to be a little bit more flexible. You know, I was very fortunate with True Detective because we'd had all 8 episodes. So it really
felt...
They were all written. The tricky part with that one was because we skipped back and forth in time periods.
Yeah.
So I was really interested in what happened in those 5 years. What happened in those 10 years? How did she change in those 10 years? And
right.
Who were the people that she met? And what are her relationships with her children now? And because that was obviously really important to me. And, you know, Nick was really helpful because he had like a biography of sorts for all of these characters. So, you know, you'd have a question. You're like, okay, well, it's 10 years later now. What happened? And you'd have this book and you'd have all this information and you could just take it all in, and you got your wheels spinning. So it was really nice to have that tool. It was invaluable. And I find like that's what's great about this process is that you develop these long-term sort of creative relationships over the course of 10, 13 episodes now.
The thing that fascinates me about acting, and I think this is because I'm not an actor, but it seems obvious once you get into it, is how often a scene is about something else and the subtext that's involved and how much information is transmitted to the audience through acts that in our own lives don't take on that significance. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And that's the beauty of story, is that we have the ability to add significance to an act. And mm-hmm. I was thinking about sex, as I often do.
Yeah. don't we all?
But I was thinking about the subtext of a lot of the sex scenes that you've had to do,
yeah.
And I realized, like, the act is a stand-in for something completely different mm-hmm. going on. Like, in Trucker, sex is a drug that's mm-hmm. used to hide, like heroin or something.
Yes.
It's used to forget your problems. And there's this guilty disgust about it right when it's over, mm-hmm. almost like a guy in a way.
She was a total guy.
Yeah, I feel like that. The sex scene in Trucker is that feeling of, what did I just do? And mm-hmm. I have to immediately get this person
like,
out of my room.
Yeah.
And then I think in True Detective, that's complete revenge. It's a manipulation. Mm-hmm. And then I think in The Path, there's something even more diabolical going on mm-hmm. in that there is a need to couple with your partner to restore your confidence in the thing that we both believe in
yes.
a brainwash. Like,
uh-huh.
So I wonder, just from an actor standpoint, because first off, I haven't been in those situations, but I wonder how you approach those things from a subtextual mm-hmm. Approach and how that influences the way you look at that, because it's not like you just get to be, you know, like most of us are in our real lives, just in love and enjoying ourselves.
Yeah. That's a really I haven't even really thought about it that much in terms of all those sex scenes, but there is so much subtext going on. And thank you for recognizing that, because some people sort of just deduce them. It's a good example. A lot
of
times people deduce those scenes to, you know, and to me, they're powerful opportunities because you see people very vulnerable and you see people very truthful. Trucker, for example, My inspiration really for that role, James and I spoke a lot about this, was actually a Mustang, a horse. Mustang,
like a wild horse.
A wild horse.
No kidding.
Yeah, that couldn't be corralled. And so I had a tattoo of her on my arm, and then I think I put a Mustang on my truck. That was someone that you couldn't keep hold of. So... And I took that into every scene that I was in. So
is that like a key that you can take into a sex scene? You can take it into a scene with your son?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Take it into every single scene I did. Took it in my body language, you know, everything. And so that scene was inspired by a Mustang. You know, you're going to have sex, and Now that wasn't the intimate part. The intimate part is the part after the sex, when I get off of you and I sit on the edge of the bed and you're still sitting there. Like, now you need to leave.
Yeah, which is not intimate at all.
Yeah, exactly. So leave now.
But that's where you're most vulnerable, is not during sex. It's when you're sitting
there. Yeah, because for me, that was the opening scene of the movie. And so I wanted audiences to understand who this woman was right off the bat. And then I love that scene afterwards. She leaves the hotel room, and it's that long tracking shot where James follows me, and it's that long walk in the dark, and I'm cool. Like, I'm fine. I just got what I wanted, which was off, and then I got you out of my room, and now I'm going to hit the road again.
And there's so much information for the audience there.
There's so much information, yeah.
No, and I guess, you know, when you think about sex scenes with beautiful women, you know, the first thought, I think, is this gratuitous? Is this because there is some producer that this is how they sell them?
Yeah.
And I'm sure you've been in those situations as well. And it's not, I mean, is it a totally different thing when you're like, well, why really are we doing this? I mean, have you had that situation too?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I'd be lying if I didn't say I was. I mean, there have been a couple of films where I know, what was it? I knew for Kiss Kiss Bang Bang that it was like, you're going to be topless for this.
But that's such a noir stylistic movie.
But it was such a noir. But it was like they, and you know, listen, I'm not that, I'm not that modest of a person. I'm very, you know, I'm very comfortable with my body. Again, I think that comes from like years of modeling, and you just sort of disrobe in front of people, and I'm very comfortable in my skin. And then I remember, you know, that it's going to be a spider, and thank God I'm not afraid of insects or anything like that. But Robert was scared to death of that spider, by the way.
He was freaking.
He's like, are we almost done? Did we get it? And I was like, it's okay, dude. He's like, oh my God, don't touch it. It's moving, you know? And I was just amazed. I was like, they have a spider wrangler. What's a spider wrangler? You know?
So, look, you learned a lot of things then.
I did. Oh my gosh, you have no idea. I should have learned how to make my mark. Still work on that. But, you know, it's true. You know you're going to be in situations where, but I don't want it to be gratuitous. I mean, for example, I didn't think that she would have her top off, you know, in Trucker.
In Trucker,
for example. I'm like, well, she's not going to have her top.
She's just getting down to business.
She's just, you know what I mean? She's just picked up the guy over in the truck stop, and she's just going to take off all she needs to take off. For instance, for True Detective, you know, that scene was really...
That was a dark, sad scene. Yeah.
You know, when we went to rehearse that scene, nobody had any idea of how we were going to shoot that. We started running the lines, and initially the scene was separated. So we sort of do the deed, and then they cut away to some other scene in the show, and then they come back to us, and then I tell him... But when we rehearsed it, it ended up being so raw. We're trying to figure out, like, what's the position and the blocking, and I come from behind him, and it's like that seduction, that manipulation where I've come in, and then, you know, Matthew grabs me, and he's like, I can't take it, and then, you know, pushes me against the counter, and that's the way we do it. And it becomes really raw and intense. And we loved that because the camera then could be here. Then I went, oh, we can see the change in her now. And I thought, well, that's really powerful that now you see, oh no, she just got him. And then that's what motivates me to turn around. And then he sees it on my face. And then he realized I've just played him as opposed to breaking up. And then when Matthew and I played it out that way, we both looked at each other. We, like, looked at Carrie. You know, we were like, that's how it has to play.
Yeah.
You can't break that up because it made it that much more powerful in that moment. And so we played it out that way. And that was, you know, I remember when we finished that rehearsal, we walked out of the house. It was like midnight. We were shooting all night. And Matthew, like, gave me a hug. And he was like, all right, we're just going to go for it, right? And I was like, of course. And he was like, give me a hug. Let's just go for it. Let's just have a shot of tequila and let's just go for it. It's like, all right, man, let's just do it. And we came back in and, you know, we shot it and it got really intense. I mean, there were things that were cut out. You know, there were things that we shattered and broke and, you know, became a very raw scene, and it was beautiful, and I loved it. And it was honestly the reason why I signed on to do the show. You know, people kind of misunderstood the character from the beginning and sort of said, oh, it's really, it's just a misogynistic show or whatever. And I'm like, oh, just wait, just keep watching. You know, just keep watching. You know things that other people don't know. And I really liked that scene because she was such a slow burn of a character. And I felt like she was sort of taking her power back. That's what drew me. I saw her as someone whose family was so, so important.
Yeah.
And I knew that he would never, ever forgive me for that, for sleeping with Rust. And I knew that he'd be out of our lives for good. And it was complete self-protection mode. And that's the way that I saw it, as her just keeping her sanity and keeping her life together and getting rid of him completely.
You know, it's so interesting how many layers of what's going on there that you know, it's such a bigger statement on sometimes how a relationship can be so confining.
Yes.
And people take desperate measures to get out.
Yeah, I mean, it was like, you know, his behavior was affecting me, it was affecting our daughters, who he was a bad example for. And it was like, well, what would be the thing that could most... What closes the door permanently?
Yeah.
Like, what do I do for self-preservation? And that was it. And so that's when I walked in. And so I never, you know, the thing is, you always hear actors talk about their characters this way, but it's true. You know, I never judge them. There's always a reason. And so many people were so upset with me, you know, for having done that, but they didn't know why I did it. But I always think it's really fascinating because I never want you to sort of approve of everything that anybody does or any of my choices, or be, it's like that, oh, it's not likable. I just want to punch somebody in the face when they say, well, it's not likable that they would do that. That's like a real, would somebody really do that? And I just think, you know, I don't care if you don't like her. I want you to put yourself in her shoes. I want you to relate to her for a second.
Yeah.
Because you're not always likable. Whoever's saying that is not always likable. I'm not always likable, you know, but I want to be truthful to how somebody really might be in that situation. And I loved that she was so desperate after all of that, that it was self-preservation for her.
Well, you know, that's one of the things I admire most about you, your body of work, is that you've made several choices like that. On Trucker, you decided to play someone who, for much of the movie, is unlikable.
Not maternal.
Yeah. And even, like, just qualities that we don't aspire to, like impatience, mm-hmm. and being unemotional and
disconnected.
Even knowing when you've hurt a kid's feelings, just letting them sit with it. Mm-hmm. And I think in Fort Bliss, you're not likable for some of it. And I think that in The Path, I think that that's another choice where it's like, here's someone that, I mean, that's a huge challenge if we can talk about that, because the assumption when you're in a cult is you've been sort of brainwashed, right? And it's hard to make that relatable, let alone, of course you can't judge it to play her, you can't judge her. But where, as an actor, I wonder where playing a character like that's actually sort of delusional, is that more fun tools to play with, or a different set of tools that you've had to use before?
Well, what I love about the idea of playing her, and you, and again, you say delusional, and most people will, but I say convicted, and I say
convicted.
And I say someone who has so much inner strength, because the interesting thing when I thought about faith, I grew up Catholic. I'm not a practicing Catholic anymore, but I would say that I'm a very spiritual person. And what I kind of find fascinating about the show is that people can relate to it. It's about religion or faith or spirituality or not having any at all. So in some way, everybody, it defines somebody, whether you've subscribed to it or you don't subscribe to it, you're aware of the way in which it, the psychology of it behind, and how it affects people and people of, that are of the same think tank, basically, for lack of a better word. So I love that this person, I grew up within this and was so, it allowed her to be comfortable and serene and non-emotional in a way. So when
she just knows.
See, even because she knows that this is the way that it is, and if something happens, if somebody transgresses, as they do in the show, that there are tools and processes that you go through, and then it'll all be okay, and then you'll move forward. Like, she can take great comfort in that, and as a result of that, she can play someone who is very calm, cool, and collected. And that's what I love about starting this character off this way, and then you start to see her unravel. It's so much more interesting to start to recognize yourself unravel as a character than to already be unraveling, to think you know who you are. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I liked the idea of, like, she thinks she knows who she is. Like, she thinks she knows, and then all of a sudden the world starts to implode around her, and then I'm like, I want to see quiet moments where she doesn't say a word, but she's like recognizing who she is.
Yeah.
She's like, oh, fuck, I'm not calm, cool. Oh my God, I am, wow, I am starting to get emotional. Okay, this is weird. You know, that's all that. And I'm like, and then as an audience, to see somebody recognizing that they're starting to unravel is far, far more intense and I think intriguing to watch than the alternative, which is...
You entered the film or the TV show with character flaws that you know,
yeah,
and you're struggling. And I think that's fascinating.
Yeah, and it's a very, you know, it's walking that fine balance, certainly. I like the idea of the show because I think it explores the idea of what people do in the name of religion, whether it's good and for bad. And I think that's what's really interesting is that it's not so black and white. It's like that gray area. Well, what will you do to sacrifice... You know, that's kind of in a gray area, but you're doing it for the greater good. You know what I mean?
The justification process.
What's the justification process? And I think that's what's interesting is that you can be good, but then you can be completely deplorable at the same time, all in the name of religion. And I think that's what people, I hope, will find fascinating about the show and kind of talk about the show, because I think that everybody can kind of relate to it in that, the psychology of what religion is and what it means to people and what they do.
I mean, it's fascinating. It's and it's something where you can see that there's so many avenues to explore.
Yes.
It is not, you don't have to keep on inventing ways for the characters to do the same things. I mean,
yes,
it keeps expanding and branching out. No, it's a fascinating show. And I think your story is just amazing. And to come from a non-entertainment, non-acting world and find it in the way you did, it's a really cool story.
Thank you very, very much.
And it's great to finally sort of get to know you better.
Nice to know you better.
Yeah. Well, thank you for doing
this.
Thank
you. Thank you very much. And if, you know, that veil ever comes around, I'd be happy
Let's
to
do it.
It.
You know, we missed an opportunity here. We should have put a veil over you for the entire time.
Exactly. Exactly.
Don't put your name on the slate and then we'll just have a conversation.
Yeah.
No one can judge you.
Yeah. Awesome, man.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sam.
Hey folks, that's our show for this time. Thanks for listening as always, and make sure to join me next time when I sit down with the supremely talented actor, director, and musician, Don Cheadle.
There are times when I'm playing trumpet, bass, piano, whatever, that I go, wow, if I had then, now I would. But there's also an understanding, well, do it now. If you want that, you do it now and you get as good as you get. Everybody wants to play like Keith Jarrett. You probably won't be able to. Or maybe you will. Who knows? But I know that you won't by sitting here going, man, I wish I could. We'll start playing.
Watch him in Hotel Rwanda, Devil in a Blue Dress, and House of Lies, and you quickly realize few actors can match him for range and nuance. He's also a humanitarian activist, not to mention a fine poker player. But apparently that's not enough. Don recently added writer and director to his resume with Miles Ahead, a film he once hoped would be preceded by the apocalypse. We'll talk about that experience and why the movie may rub some people the wrong way. He'll also reveal what led him to choose acting over music and the play that first inspired him. I'll give you a hint, it wasn't Chekhov. So make your guess now, and I'll see you next time, off camera.